Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
We continue our journey through the early pro football teams of the All-America Football Conference by talking about the Chicago Rockets. They were perhaps the doormat of the AAFC, but don't worry, we have Joe Ziemba here to make it a blast. That information on the Rockets coming up with Joe in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we are in that same journey mode. We are in early football in the 1940s, the late 1940s, talking about the All-American Football Conference. We're going team by team. And in this episode, we have Joe Ziemba, the great Chicago football historian, is going to talk to us about the Chicago Rockets. Joe Ziemba, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Darren, always a pleasure to be here, and I'm kind of excited because I'm not an expert on the Chicago Rockets, but by participating in, as always, one of your informative programs, it forced me to dig a little deeper into a team that really is unique as well as disappointing. I mean, here's a club with connections to a real-life Chicago mob assassination, a cross-country truck demonstration, a player's potential strike that cost a coach's job two games into a season, and a connection to one of the most famous locations in the world. It's all with the Chicago Rockets, a miserable team that never did win many games on the field or at the gate, but boy, did they try hard.
Boy, Joe, you give better teases than the newscasters before they go to commercial break to keep the listeners going, because you have me on the edge of the seat. I'm sure the listeners too. So you sound like some great stories from the Rockets team. So maybe if you could tell us a little bit about, you know, we know a little bit about from some previous episodes how the AAFC was formed with Arch Ward. How exactly did the Rockets come to be, and maybe who founded them, who owned them, and maybe the original name, if you know anything about that?
Sure. I'm not quite sure about the name, but I do know the owner, a guy named John L. Jack Keeshan, who was a contemporary of Arch Ward, who was the brilliant sports editor of the Chicago Tribune. As you know, he started the Major League All-Star Game, the College Football All-Star Game, where the colleges and the pros met every August in Chicago before over 100,000 people, and he wanted more. And I said, the guy was brilliant. So he hatched this idea for the All-American Football Conference, and in September of 1944 was the first mention that this league was going to be started, and one of the people who were interested was John Keeshan of Chicago for the Chicago franchise. At that time, it did not have a name, but Keeshan made his fortune as the a president and owner of a Chicago trucking company that was huge at the time. There's so many interesting things about this guy. He was, for example, talked about in Fortune magazine about how he made his fortune so easy. Fortune said, besides muscles and guts, Keeshan has brains and persistence and ambition and prodigious energy. For these reasons, he has money, and he flaunts the title of Keeshan Transcontinental Freight Lines. So he made his money in trucking. It grew from literally nothing. Basically, he started as a kid at the age of 13 with a horse-drawn truck in Chicago. And over the next three decades or so, he built Keeshan Freight Lines into something that became the biggest privately owned trucking company in the United States. He had over 3,000 employees, 2,000 trucks, and 17,000 miles of routes, crossing mostly the Midwest and the East. And he gained some national attention back in 1935 when he decided to establish a new record for a truck convoy in terms of shipping. How quickly could a truck get from Chicago to Los Angeles? So he sent, I think, four or five trucks with about 90,000 pounds of freight to leave Chicago in late 1935. And it took him only 3 days to cross country because the trucks kept running. They pre-planned the stops. And everyone thought, wow, this Keeshan is really something, because as a true executive with some marketing perspective, he started out leading the convoys that left Chicago, got out quickly, sat around for a couple of days, then caught one of those early transcontinental flights over to Los Angeles so he could jump in the truck and be leading it into Los Angeles with the crowd cheering. And got him a lot of national attention because of the quickness and showed how rapidly that a trucking company could move freight if it had to. In this case, it would have broken all the modern rules of driver's rest, et cetera, because he had different drivers on the truck. As I mentioned, pre-planned the stops that they made along the way. But he wanted to do more. And one of the things he became involved with was becoming a part owner of and president of the National Jockey Club in Chicago, which owned and operated Sportsman's Park. And that's a racetrack that had some connections to the Al Capone mob earlier. In fact, in 1939, one of the officers of the club was named Edward O'Hara, and he was assassinated leaving work one day from Sportsman's Park. And with his demise, Keeshan was allowed to buy the stock of Edward O'Hara. But the story doesn't end there, Darren. O'Hara had been marked because by the mob. Apparently, he had turned some information against Al Capone several years earlier during Capone's accounting and tax trial. And he was a marked man. It just took the mob a few years to get to him. But more of the interesting story about him was that his son, Butch, that is the late Mr. Edward, son Butch was part of the Air Force, Army Air Force in World War II, won the Medal of Honor in the Pacific. He served a tour, came back all in one piece, but then supposedly he was embarrassed by his father's reputation. He went back and unfortunately lost his life in the Pacific. But Butch O'Hare is the name that O'Hare International Airport, that's who it's named after. So a connection, a little bit of a stretch to the Chicago Rockets, because the death of his father allowed Jack Keeshan to buy into Sportsman's Park. And then when he was unable to buy a part of the Chicago White Sox or any other sports team, he met with Arch Ward. And Art said, hey, why don't you be part of our new football conference that we're going to be starting? And even though they're going up against the well-established Chicago Bears and Chicago Cardinals, Keeshan had the team called the Chicago Rockets. And one of the things about him, which Arch Ward loved, was Keeshan had, I'm going to say this politely, a big mouth. He was not afraid. He was unfiltered, said what he wanted to do. Always caused a stir and would do anything to promote his team in those early days. So he was a very prominent member of the ownership club for the All-American Football Conference when it started. He had about 2 years to get ready to put a team on the field, which he did at that point. He went about looking to see who he could get to represent it. He always wanted the best in the business to see what they could do on the football field, knowing full well that he was going to be competing against two other pro teams in the city of Chicago.
Wow, that's that it does take some brass tacks there to do that, especially the two really established football teams too, two of the older ones, the oldest one and what the second or third oldest team in the league.
Yeah.
And
Keeshan, besides having a mouth that ran a little bit, he had a little bit of a temper. In 1942, he was arrested for knocking out a rival trucking company executive and breaking his jaw. So he got off of that, as they usually do, but he was a colorful individual. In fact, the league used him in April of 1945 to work with the great Paul Brown to talk with the established National Football League to see if there might be a way of the two leagues cooperating. And that's when Commissioner Ellen Layden of the NFL said in April of 45, he declined the kind offer and said, let them get a football and play a game first. So that was kind of cool that Keeshan, again, very prominent, very visible. He never stopped promoting. And one of the very first major things that he came up with in Chicago was in February of 1945, he signed a lease to use Soldier Field on the lakefront in Chicago, which, of course, the Chicago Bears still use. But back then, it wasn't used that much for football. There was annual games or high school games played there. The Prep Bowl, it was called, which drew over 100,000 people. Notre Dame used it a few times. So he signed a lease on Soldier Field for 10 years. And his plan was, as the league itself was trying to be unique, that he would play his games on a Friday night so he wouldn't compete or other nights with the Bears and the Cardinals. And the Chicago Park District was going to get 10% of the gross up to 100,000. And with the biggest discount that if the gate was over 250,000, which it never was, the Chicago Park District would get 6% of that. So he had a bit of a varying requirement of what he would pay for Soldier Field. And when they finally took their first game, he drew over 51,000 people. But there was still a lot of work to come before that first game in 1946. As we mentioned, they had a couple of years to get ready. And he had to prepare a team, find a coach. One of the first things he did after the lease was hiring a Marine Lieutenant Colonel named Dick Handley to be his coach and general manager for the squad. So this is a year and a half before the team would actually take the field. And at the time, Handley, who was a former coach at Northwestern, was the coach of the El Toro California football team, which is a very powerful team. But it also included one of the brightest stars that was in college a couple of years earlier called Elroy Crazy Legs Hirsch. And so one of the mistakes that Mr. Keeshan made was varying on his position as to whether he had signed Hirsch or not. In March of 1945, the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin, where the university is located and where Hirsch had gone to school, said, "We hope he, Hirsch, returns to the Badger school, but it looks as though Elroy has grabbed the pro-gravy train and has decided to get his share of the lettuce floating around." But what a great quote. But nothing was really confirmed then. But one time, and it occurred in later that year in December, apparently Elroy Hirsch ran into Keeshan in Denver and someone heard him call him boss. And so that started some problems because Hirsch still had some eligibility left with the colleges. But apparently if he signed with the Rockets, he would no longer be able to play in college. But in December of 1945, Jim Crowley, who was the head of the new league, said, yeah, Hirsch had signed with Chicago. That was the end of the story. So Elroy Hirsch played with the Rockets when he got out of the service. He was called Crazy Legs for his wacky running style, which looked like his legs were gyrating in six different directions all at the same time, according to the Chicago Daily News. He eventually moved over to the Los Angeles Rams and was all pro three times and elected to the NFL Hall of Fame in 1968. But back in 1945, the world was still waiting for the decision on Crazy Legs Hirsch. So the league was still a year or so from starting when Mr. Keeshan, who we've been talking a lot about, resigned suddenly as president of his own company, and he got rid of all his connections with the firm because he was very, very upset with impossible labor demands, he called it. And less than 3 months later, the company did file for a reorganization and had a bankruptcy with assets a lot less than its liabilities. So he got out at the right time, even though it was kind of unusual. And someone said, what are you doing this for? I mean, you can bring the company back as you always did. And they also mentioned that perhaps this trucking company didn't have the value that it once had. And Keesham said, yeah, it may not be worth nothing now, but I don't want to be the richest man in the cemetery. I want to have some fun. So he still had his football team. Later on, he did get back in the trucking business. But I'm off a little bit talking too much about Jack Keeshan. Back to the league itself. And in September of 1945, Commissioner Crowley was talking about what would make the league different, especially in a town like Chicago, where there'd be plenty of competition. And he figured, and the league figured, that if they could start earlier, they might get done before the bad winter set in and really hindered attendance. So Crowley mentioned, we can get off to an earlier start than the National Football League because we won't have to depend on baseball parks for our fields. We can start around Labor Day, and our northern teams can finish their home seasons before the real bad weather sets in and then play out the rest of their schedules in our southern cities. So that was an interesting aspect of football. Of course, now we have dome stadiums, et cetera. But another major announcement for Chicago was Ernie Nevers, the great Chicago Cardinal, who had been now is in the Hall of Fame, still holds the NFL record for 40 points scored in one game back in 1929 against the Bears. He was hired by the Rockets to help out with Coach Dick Handley. And initially, Nevers would scout the Rockies and the West Coast. And he had already signed up 24 folks for playing in 1946. So it was all working towards getting that team on the field, and having a big name like Ernie Nevers certainly helped the visibility of the new team and the new league. Keeshan also offered something a little different than other teams couldn't. And I'm thinking back to when George Halas was with the Decatur Staleys back in 1920. He offered the players a job. And back then, everybody, just about everybody, had to work a part-time job. But Keeshan, when he started the company before he backed away, had mentioned that he would get his players jobs within his company. And he was asked, what does he look for most in a player and an employee? And he said, loyalty, he said. That comes first. I'll follow them for some time to see if they have talents that we can use. Then if they're reliable and trustworthy, I send for them and put them in their position. But he also made a prediction for his football team. He was really happy with Lieutenant Colonel Dick Handley and Ernie Nevers as his coaches, saying they're mighty solid football men. And 2 years from now, Jack Keeshan said, I want my men in the All-Star game. I've always had champions. I'll have them again. So big words from a guy, Jack Keeshan, at the time. He also created a couple more headlines in 1945 when he said that he wanted to play the very first game of the league in 1946, which would turn out to be an exhibition game by an unknown opponent, probably in Denver in 1946, and put down $1,000 guarantee, which is kind of big money at the time. And then he made even a bigger splash. And we mentioned Dick Handley, the coach, was also coaching the El Toro Marine team. And Keeshan swept in. And he claimed that he signed a large percentage of that team to play for the Chicago Rockets. So, again, he was asked about Elroy Hirsch, if he was really joining the Rockets. And Keeshan commented, when I say a player is signed, he's signed. And I say that Hirsch will be with us next year in Chicago. So he now had the basis of a pretty strong team just based on all the service guys who had been with Handley at El Toro. And as the season progressed, 1946 would be the kickoff in September of 46 for the league. Keeshan made a couple of major signings. It was assumed that he had Hirsch already signed up. And then in July of 46, he signed tailback Bob Hunchy Hornschmeyer from Indiana, who led the nation in total offense and passing in 1943. He then went to the U.S. Naval Academy. And so this is a major signing by the league, and it paid off immediately. As a rookie, he rated among the top players in the conference, in the pro conference, with 1,266 passing yards, 14 passing touchdowns, 375 rushing yards, and he also was among the leaders in punt and kickoff return yards. So a great player to add to the very, very young Chicago Rockets. He ended up playing in through 46, but only a couple games in 47 before he was traded to another team in the league. And later in 46, hopefully not a portent of bad things to come for the team, but a very highly regarded halfback named Bill MacArthur suffered a severe leg injury in August of 1946 during workouts. And the damage was so severe that he actually had his leg removed. So a bad way to start the season for the Chicago Rockets. But now everybody was turning to the big day, September 13th, 1946, when the Rockets would host the Cleveland Browns. As I mentioned earlier, a very nice crowd showed up of 51,962 to Soldier Field to see the Rockets lose that opener 20-6 to the Cleveland Browns. The season went okay for the team. They finished 5-6-3. But the bigger news, and again, this is a team of wacky stories. After two games, Handley, the coach, and Keeshan, the owner, had been butting heads for a while. They turned a lot of public quotes against each other. And after two games, Handley decided to resign. Of course, it looks like he was forced out. But ironically, he and Nevers sat in the stands for the third game. And later, Keeshan started picked three players to run the team as coaches, rotating, which was highly unusual. The three players were Ned Matthews, Bob Dove, and Willie Wilkin. So they were player coaches. But that experiment ended later in October when Pat Bullen was hired as the head coach. So Elroy Hirsch picked up 347 receiving yards. They used a good passing game. The only all-pro guy was Hornschmeyer from Indiana, who received second team honors from the United Press on the official team that year. And then another surprise, right after all the stuff that was going on with the team, Keeshan separated himself from another business by selling his interest in Sportsman's Park to Charles Bidwell, the owner of the Chicago Cardinals. So our links between the teams continue. Keeshan wasn't done with surprises. So to end the year on December 30th, 1946, he sold the team to Commissioner Jim Crowley and two of Crowley's boyhood friends from Green Bay. Keeshan said at the time, "I have said repeatedly that I intend to bring the country's outstanding football leader to Chicago, and the 1947 coach of the Rockets, Jim Crowley, is that man. But he accepted the job only if he gained control of the club. So Keeshan, the most visible owner in the league, stepped away at the end of 1946.
Wow. I mean, he had a lot to do in just a short amount of time with that team, that's for sure. That's just a span of, what, a year and a half?
From
44 through 46? Wow, that is a... I don't know if I'd do that in myself in a year. He did all that with just one football team.
Plenty of activity. Well, with the coach and the owner out of the way, Jim Crowley took over in 1947, and the team had a tough time. They finished 0-10. Crowley didn't last the season as coach. Hampton Poole took over for the last four games, and overall the team was 1-13. So a last place finish for the squad. More changes occurred next year. Ed McKeever in 1948 took over, and the team was starting to get a little bit of support on the south side of Chicago, and it's a very small newspaper called the Daily Calumet. It was encouraging fans to have a full house for the training camp at Yates Stadium in Chicago for the new Chicago Rockets football team. And if you attended, that would assure the needy local inhabitants of a more cheerful and comfortable winter for some reason than if you showed up for a game in the summer of 1948. But the team is really supported by that paper, which said the new Chicago Rockets have soared to preeminence in the football world. This is a team that was 1-13 the year before. It has been almost completely reorganized in its every phase, rehabilitated in personnel, ownership, sponsorship, and directorship, into a glorious, glamorous, star-studded squad of All-Americans in an All-American league. Now, how can anyone, excuse me, turn down an offer to see a team like that? So how did the 1948 Chicago Rockets react? Not too good. They finished 1-13 again. So under new coach Ed McKeever, things did not go well. But the only success the team was having in those days was being able to play against some teams and not really get blown out that bad, but they were not certainly not competitive. So that brought us then to the 1949 season. And 1949 turned out to be the fourth and final season for the Rockets in the conference. They did improve a bit on their record in 1949, and they changed their name to the Chicago Hornets, finishing 4-8 under pretty much a legendary NFL coach named Ray Flaherty. And so that helped them to move up a notch in the standings. They trained at Ripon College in Wisconsin. Had a couple of ex-pros from the area like Johnny Clement from the Cardinals playing, Ray Ramsey. But again, not a whole lot of success on the field. So with the new name, new ownership came in again, but not a very good result in the standings. So they failed to qualify for the playoffs, and the team then folded with the league. Some of the teams, as we know, did go to the NFL, but not the Chicago Rockets. They are now a footnote to football history in the Chicago area. Now, one of the neat things about the league is with having Arch Ward and the Chicago Tribune behind the league, that even though the teams were not quite as talented, talking about the Chicago Rockets, they did generate a great deal of publicity in Chicago. And sometimes at the expense of the Bears and the Cardinals, because Arch Ward really, truly wanted his lead to succeed. In fact, he was the founder of the College Football All-Star Game, and he tried to have the All-American Football Conference champion replace the NFL champion in the annual All-Star Game, which did not go over well with the NFL owners. So that did not go forward at all. So that, Darren, is a brief history of the energetic, the not enormously talented, but the fun Chicago Rockets, who, while they lasted, we can at least say they fielded a football team in the professional league.
Well, they definitely had an interesting short history, but some great stories from there. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. Now, you know, one thing that came to mind is, you know, the poor football fans in Chicago, you know, thank God they had the Bears. I'm not sure the Bears, I think, were pretty decent in that era, but you had to think about those mid-40s and late-40s between the Rockets and, you know, the Pittsburgh Cardinal team that they put together. There's some horrific teams that they had to watch in their home stadiums there in Chicago.
It did, and the Bears and the Cardinals did rebound late in the 40s. The Bears won the 46 NFL championship, and the Cardinals won in 47. And lost in the title game in 48, of course. And it's interesting when you talk about some of the attendance. The Rockets' opening day attendance, as we mentioned, about 52,000 that very first game was probably their best. And at the time, the Tribune claimed it was the biggest crowd ever to see a pro football game in Chicago. But as the days and weeks and years wound down, it was not unusual to see a little over 2,000 paying customers see the Rockets play at Soldier Field, which at the time sat about 120,000. So must have looked pretty darn vacant.
Yeah. Jeez, I'll say. Wow, that is some great history, some great digging and research on that, Joe. We really appreciate you telling the stories of the Chicago Rockets. Maybe what do you have coming up on When Football is Football that we can look forward to?
Well, coming up on Football is Football, I think our current show is about Billy Cross, perhaps the smallest man ever to play for the Cardinals in modern times. We have a couple of brothers coming up that, even though no one knew their real names, they were quite influential in steering the Cardinals and the NFL to some success in the early 1920s. So there's always something that we're looking forward to sharing. One of our favorite ones, which we got a lot of good response, was talking about Doug Atkins, Instead of the smallest man in football, he was one of the larger at 6'8", and a prodigious drinker as well as a prodigious force on the field. So on the Sports History Network, these shows are always logged, so you can go back and take a look at them if you like. So always fun to work with yourself and with Arnie Chapman over at the Sports History Network.
Yeah, I have to comment, both that Doug Atkins and the smallest man, I forget the comment you said, is he the mascot, I think is the way you titled that one. Those were both great episodes, and I highly encourage listeners out there to check those out. So those, as well as all the rest of the podcast that Joe does and the rest of the guys do, but those are some classics that you did, Joe, and we really appreciate the stories in those as well.
Oh, thank you so much, Darren, and they're always fun to look back into some of these kind of foggy topics and then go ahead and share them with the listeners.
Joe, again, I appreciate you spending time and sharing with us again and sharing that great Chicago football history that we love to hear. So thanks again.
And thank you as well for having me again. I'm hoping that you were able to stay awake through all of our conversation today. I know it was one-sided and I apologize, but certainly a blast and always great to talk with you, Darren. Thank you very much.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, it's found right here on the Sports History Network.